Okay, we'll bring to order the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gothier.
Here.
Boonhagen. Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer. Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Present.
Smith.
Here. Okay, a quorum being present, we'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes from April 28th, 2011.
Move approval.
Representative Smith moves the minutes of April 28th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all approved. We'll say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Members, it's amazing. I don't think we have anything controversial today. It's but who knows?
We'll find something.
Yeah, we'll find something. We'll start out with Representative Loon's House File 441. Chair will move House File 441 be recommended to pass and move to taxes. Is that correct, Representative Loon?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Loon, you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 441 is really, I consider it really an update almost to our collection of 911 fees from wireless customers. With the advent of wireless phones, which become much more and more popular, there are many other types of varieties that customers may have other than those with a monthly contract with their provider. And many of them, consumers have gone to prepaid, so where you may obtain a phone and a number from a provider, but go to a local retailer to purchase minutes and minute cards. I know I have two teenage daughters, and that's what we do. And so the problem is with that is the fees that are collected currently from the carriers and submitted to Department of Public Safety, we're not certain that it's accurately collecting from those prepaid customers, which is our statute. Under our statute, everyone with a phone number and access to 911 is required to pay into our system to keep it viable and functioning. And so in order to update that, this bill has retailers collect the 911 and the TAM fee, which goes to Commerce for the relay service for citizens with disabilities, and would go from the retailers to Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue will then split off the TAM fee, which is 10 cents, and that to Commerce, split off the 911 fee, which is currently 80 cents. Send that to public safety. The retailers would be keeping 3% of the fee that they collect for their trouble for collecting it and submitting it, and revenue would have 2% for their work to collect those fees and disseminate them and provide that information to public safety. There's been extensive work with the wireless companies, with the retailers, and with the Department of Public Safety to make sure that this would function in the best possible way. And we've also asked and have obtained agreement with Public Safety for them to do a look back at the fees collected under prepaid wireless and going to this route as to how much would be coming in if this bill is made law and goes into effect. We would be collecting fees under this new system for prepaid for about a month, a little over a month, and would ask the Commissioner of Public Safety to review how much is coming in and also to add that as a separate point of information in their annual report to the legislature. My goal here is to make sure that we are collecting an adequate amount for the 911 system, certainly not to over-collect from consumers. And so if by chance this happens to bring in more funds, we would ask the Commissioner of Public Safety to review that and perhaps reduce the 911 fee for all customers, as everyone pays on your wired line or hard line as well as your wireless telephone. So With that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for the committee's support, and I would entertain any questions you might have.
Okay, Representative Loon, we have Representative Gauthier first up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Loon, I'm looking at this fiscal note. I support your bill, but the page one has some cost to it, and can you just explain that so it's clear?
Yes, Representative Gauthier, I'd be happy to. And I would note for the committee that this fiscal note was done, was the bill as introduced. And as introduced, we originally proposed a fee of 38 cents. And again, this the amount of the fee was a fair amount of back and forth between myself and public safety is to try to arrive at an amount that was fair for wireless, for prepaid customers. They felt, and this fiscal note reflected, that 38 cents would be under-collecting for the fund. So we have arrived at an agreement at 80 cents, which is the same amount all other customers pay, but with the possibility of reducing that if we're seeing that more funds are coming in than is necessary.
Thank you, Representative Loon.
Representative Gauthier, I think staff also, Mr. Carter, had some to add there.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair and members, there is the first engrossment of the bill out there that you will be receiving shortly, and we have requested a new fiscal note on that. It should be due early next week.
Okay.
Any other questions? Representative Moran.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Representative Loon. And thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I know we are a state that's in, we have a great deficit, $5.2 billion. And we must create revenue to really get out of this debt, and I know it's no other way that we're going to do this and then do it in the way that we're really supporting and helping, you know, our state and the people of our state. But I just, for some reason, I always have a problem just doing it on the back of the poor people, because I believe that, you know, and usually prepaid is for those who cannot afford to just have a regular account with T-Mobile or others, you know, and I'm really about trying to lift people out of poverty. So whether, and I understand, I read your bill, and I know that others do pay a fee to use 911, but I just wish we can find other ways to raise revenue, like big businesses and corporations who pay no taxes at all, and maybe we can tap into some of their resources and really collect some real revenue that we need for our state. I guess my question to you is, do you see an impact on this bill on the population who are prepaying to have a phone for emergency reasons, to just stay in contact with family members, just to, you know, incorporate themselves into the community?
Thank you for the question, Representative Moran. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think the impact of this on the poor, and specifically poor who use prepaid wireless, is a great concern to me. And I think if Mr. Whitehead from Department of Public Safety wishes to comment, could comment on many, many hours we discussed about at what level do we establish this fee. And again, public safety, I think, has a very common sense argument that our statute is that everyone who has a telephone has to pay into the fee, and the fee is the same for everyone. And the fee really is to go to make sure that our system is adequate and it's updated to keep up with technology and that. But I am also very sensitive to the fact that people who have prepaid wireless, maybe people who either can't afford a wireless contract, not only just those who don't want to, because those people may need to buy the minutes for their phone every week versus once a month because of their financial situation and their cash flow. And I'm very sensitive to the fact then that those people may be paying four times a month into the system as opposed to once a month for people under a monthly contract. My hope is by asking DPS, again, to do a look back at what's coming in, and they must segregate very separately money from prepaid wireless fees coming in, that they would be able to look at what is coming in, if it is coming in an amount that is more than they're receiving now, more than is necessary to keep the fund going, they would reduce that fee. And that is sincerely my hope.
Representative Moran.
Thank you. I hope that's not, I also hope that's the hope. So would you be willing to, maybe you or your someone follow through to, you know, oversight and of that?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, and, absolutely. And I would ask really for assistance with this committee, which I unfortunately don't sit on, but I would ask that members, you know, watch this closely. Again, I think it's all of our goal with this dedicated fee. It's to make sure that we have a 911 service that is responsive to all of our citizens when they need help in an emergency. And that is solely what the fund is for. It should be enough to make sure that that happens, but not more than is necessary.
And Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I have a question. Why is the, my understanding is that the liability exemption is stronger here than under regular cell phone contracts. Why is that? Why are we even getting into liabilities here?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery. I would actually defer that question to Mr. Whitehead with Department of Public Safety.
Mr. Whitehead, welcome. State your name and title and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ron Whitehead. I'm with the Department of Public Safety Emergency Communication Networks. The liability language with respect to this bill, Chair and members of the committee, was really directed at sellers, the Best Buys, the Walmarts, and so forth, that would actually be selling the bill. Now, it does include the providers. The providers in these cases are generally secondary businesses. They don't provide the actual network. For example, TracFone uses Sprint Network, I believe. They're all using somebody else's network and so forth. So they don't provide the fundamental network. And in particular, with respect to sellers, they're just selling cards as secondary sellers, so it's designed to address their concerns. Obviously, Department of Public Safety had quite a bit of extensive discussion with the wireless industry and Department of Commerce as we went through this provision. This is language that's been adopted in a number of states where they've passed this provision, so we were agreeable to maintain that language.
Why, and Mr. Chair, Mr. White, why do we have to get into liability exemptions to do a tax?
Mr. Whitehead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the sellers, the retail industry, was concerned about that provision. In addition, it does provide some language for them. As you may know, prepaid is one of those businesses that's, because of the cell phones, there's no direct contact. It's very difficult to follow up and find out who bought this service. If there's some sort of phone call made with it, it's a, you know, they're clean phones is what they'll call them in the law enforcement industry. But the sellers want to be able, if they have the information, to be able to provide it in accordance with federal law that requires the disclosure of who the phone might belong to. Largely, it's directed at the sellers who, as I say, are just selling time cards.
Representative Mullery?
I'll try to find out more about that as it goes on. Just in general, I don't like this bill. What Representative Moran already brought up, the fact that we're taxing a lot of, I know a lot of those, the usage of these are from people that can't afford it, and even more so sometimes they're worried about their kids in the inner city, and now we're going to tax them for that, for being concerned and wanting a safe way to help their kids in certain situations. And so we're instituting a new tax that goes mainly against, while it affects everybody, it affects more the poor, and at the same time, this is going into the same pot, Mr. Whitehead, as we just stole money for the general fund from. So I don't agree with a system of taxing, a new tax on the poor to fill a fund, the same fund, exactly the same fund, where money was put into the general fund for other uses. It just doesn't make sense.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm generally supportive of this bill because I think the 911 system really does need to be upgraded and move to a uniform digital system, and that's going to cost some money. My main concern had to do with the whole dedication issue that you mentioned, that in fact it stays dedicated to that purpose. And as Representative Mulry noted, that the fund doesn't get rated to backfill the general fund as was proposed for this session. But I think that the general thrust of the bill is clearly needed. But no response, I guess.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Chairman Cornish. I share some of Representative Mulry's concerns also, but maybe we need legislation that prohibits the legislature from raiding designated funds.
So, any more questions? If none, Chair restates the motion. House File 441 be recommended to pass and move to taxes. Questions, comments, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Thank you, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Representative Downey, are you ready? House File 229.
I don't think so.
We've heard.
Okay, members, House File 229, did I say? 229 has been to Judiciary already. It comes to us and goes from here, hopefully, to the General Register. So the Chair will move House File 229 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Representative Downey, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll give a brief description of the bill and then a little bit of the circumstances behind it, and then be available for questions, obviously, and appreciate members' support. The bill allows in adjudications of delinquent for a minor to allow the court, if the child is 15 years or older and is not part of the family of the victim, to require that the offender live 1,000 feet or 3 blocks away from their victim upon replacement into the community. Right now there is not technically any prohibition of this in state law. A judge or court could adjudicate this. However, in a circumstance that one of my constituents ran into, it appears that there's actually quite a bit of variation in practices in different courts. And in the particular case of a constituent of mine, whose elementary school daughter was abused by a next-door neighbor boy, and that boy, after being replaced back in the home, is living literally their window, literally 8 feet from this girl's house, walking out to the bus stop together in the morning, and you can imagine the circumstance that inflicts. And they plea bargained, actually, a second-degree offense in that particular case. However, going into the plea bargaining, their exclusive interest was separation for their daughter from the offender, and through the circumstances of their case and the court they were in, they were not offered that, and actually were told that that was something that wasn't done. And so this legislation would actually put it into statute for first to fifth degree offenses that the judge and the court can adjudicate this kind of a separation as part of the sentencing and the plea bargaining process. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Question, members. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess before I ask a question, is there any other testimony at all on this, one way or the other?
Is there anybody in opposition or support that needs to testify? Nope.
Mr. Chairman? If I could, I maybe should have mentioned this in my opening remarks, too. We did work with the county attorneys to fine-tune the language and added the 15-year limitation and the fact that it would not be within a family setting. So I'm not sure that they are supportive of it, but we did work with them to give them the comfort language they needed, and they aren't opposing it, certainly. So.
Well, President Mulry.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little concerned because I know the way that I know what the parents of that child feel, but I know that what society has to look at is how do we straighten the kid out, and the best way is usually in their home. That's why it'd be nice if we had somebody from that's a child expert on working on this actually here, but nobody showed up, so we're kind of lost. I guess that I'm hopefully maybe we will do the extensive juvenile justice reform task force and look at many of these kinds of issues. How do we protect both, or how protect society and the victim? It would have been nice to have somebody here, but we don't.
Representative Johnson, and then Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hello, Representative Downey. We heard this in Judiciary Committee, and the main issue there was, for me anyway, was why put into legislation this sort of thing when the judge can already do it, I guess, was the main point. And I'm still not clear on the need for it since the judge can already do it.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yeah, we did have a bit of discussion on that in Judiciary. Important component of the bill is on line 3.30 and 3.31. Today, in order for the judge to actually do this, they would have to justify how this is actually in the best interest of the offender. And in the case of this particular component of the adjudication and the sentencing, you would not have to, the judge would not have to substantiate that. And so this is actually, I think, leveling the field for the victim. It is permissive. A judge could do this today, but there's an extra kind of burden of proof, if you will, that somehow the separation is also good for the offender. And so my own experience, not personal, thankfully, but through this circumstance and looking into this more, is that there is a wide variation of practice. Families going into the plea bargaining process are not aware, and sometimes in this particular case, for example, so that they don't have this available to them when they do. So it's, as Representative Lesh mentioned in Judiciary, it's a signpost of some value, not only to the court, but also to the families. And in this particular case, I think appropriately levels the field between the victim and the offender.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, what happens? Can you explain? I'm not a lawyer. I am but a lowly middle school teacher. So I don't know what would happen if the victim and the offender are in the same family, as often happens. That's a pretty common, I hate to say common, but it's a scenario in this situation that runs fairly commonly.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slocum, we specifically exclude that in the language on 4.3 and 4. So it would not apply to intra-family situations. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you. My bad. I didn't flip over to page 4.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Downing. I think your bill does level the playing field, I'm going to support it because it's actually a bill that is promotes victims' rights, and I thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Gauthier. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, in the instance that you described earlier, what do you think should have happened?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, at the very least, I think this family should have been made aware that this was a possible disposition, a possible component of the plea bargaining, and they weren't. And so I think this bill, at the very least, would provide that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, do you think that the family of the offending youth should have been required to move? Do you think that the offender should have been separated from his family for some period of time? And if that were the case, where would he have gone? And what would you contemplate those circumstances being?
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, yeah, great question. So I think at the very least, the opportunity for the family, who in this particular case was looking for this exact component in their plea bargaining and was under the impression that it was not available to them, that it would have been part of their process, and that the judge and the whole process would at least have this as part of the options available to them. Just in terms of the potential implications and costs for the offender's family, granted that exists, but in this particular case, you need to look at it, I think, from the reverse perspective. So here is the victim's family faced with the prospect of their child and their family seriously damaged in this whole event, not brought on by them at all. And now they're the ones that have to think about moving. And everyone knows what happened to real estate prices, and they're the ones that bear that financial burden. And on top of that, there is an unpublished juvenile sex offender registry, which the victim's family now knows about. And they're left with the moral conundrum of selling their house and inviting somebody to purchase their house. And do they disclose that on their property information form? And how do they, in good conscience, sell their house to another family with little kids? So I think it's not an easy circumstance for either of the families. In this particular case, it just feels like all the weight of the problem is on the family of the victim, the emotional and other kinds of trauma and costs they've already incurred is on the victim, and then now on top of that, we're adding the potential costs of moving and all of that on them, and the moral conundrum of selling their house into that circumstance. So I just really feel like this signpost would at least mitigate a lot of that.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Downey, it sounds like, you know, and I understand what you're saying, the victim has to sees the kid every day, all the time. Why in the world there's no restriction on the judge putting all kinds of restrictions on it. It seems like we're getting bills in here like the Emily's Law bill, this one, where the judicial system just we're getting things because they didn't do things that they can already do. Maybe you're not on the committee and you don't have control of the judicial system, but it just seems like there's a lot of other things that we might in most cases be able to do before forcing a family to move or something like that. That's not very desirable.
All right. Any questions from members? 229. If not, the chair would restate the motion to move House File 229, recommended to pass, and go to the General Register. Questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Downey. And Representative Lemire. you have any testifiers that are going to testify today?
No, they came yesterday and they weren't able to make it today, so I'm all you get.
Anybody on this bill to testify opposition or support? Okay, Representative Lemire, your bill is House File 1468, and it's your wish to move it to the General Register. So the Chair will move House File 1468 to be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Representative Lemire, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Lemire, State Representative for Morrison County and Crow Wing County. If I could at this time, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an author's oral amendment.
Representative Lemire, in the number, they say, which amendment? Oral amendment?
Yes, please.
Okay, if I could state your oral amendment slowly for the staff.
On line 1.12, delete the words at auction. So it'll say, or sell the weapons to federally licensed firearm dealers as defined in section 624.7161 subdivision 1.
Okay, the Chair will move that motion, and the oral amendment on line point or 1.3 or 1.12. I'm looking at the title. We might have to do some work in the title too then. 1.12, strike the words at auction.
Yeah, and you're right.
Staff, what do you think about that title where it says at auction?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, could I just repeat the amendment with the title as well?
Yeah, the oral amendment would be line 1.12, strike the words at auction.
Yes, so Mr. Chair, and members, the amendment would be on line 1.3 to strike at auction, right, and on line 1.12 to delete at auction.
Okay, you've all heard that movement or that motion. Understand? All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Representative Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1468 authorizes law enforcement agencies to sell forfeited firearms to federally licensed firearm dealers. Current law requires that upon summary forfeiture, any contraband left either must be destroyed. Am I making that noise? Must be destroyed, otherwise they can be used by the agency for law enforcement purposes. This bill just adds one additional permissible disposition of the weapon, which will authorize the agencies to sell the firearms to a licensed firearm dealer. I'm open to any questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lemire, where would the proceeds go?
The proceeds would go to the county or the city general fund.
Mr. Chair, perhaps this is a question for Mr. Carter, but would that need to be explicitly stated in this bill? Ms. Pierce?
Ms. Pierce, go ahead.
Sure.
Well, it looked to me like we're not doing anything but adding another option here that's probably covered somewhere else in statute. But Ms. Pierce, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll double check quick, but I believe the 70-20-10 split that is currently in law would apply. So 70% would go to the law enforcement agency, 20% to the prosecuting agency, and 10% to the general fund. But I'll double check quick.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes.
Under 609-5315, as stated, that's correct. What I don't know what Madam said over there. A disposition of money is 70, 20, and 10. So that would be correct. And we could add that into the language if you would like.
Actually, I'd rather not. Into this bill, because what we're doing is using existing language and adding another option. So, okay. Any other questions? If none, Chair would restate the motion to move, recommended to pass House File 1468 and move to the General Register.
Actually,
questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, one other thing does occur to me. In this situation, then, would it be possible for the person who forfeited the weapon to just buy it back from the federally licensed arms dealer?
Representative Lemire.
I would assume if they can pass the federally firearm license, the background check, they would be allowed to purchase it back, but they'd have to pass the background check in order to do so.
That's right. They'd have to fill out the 4473, the yellow form or whatever, for the and they also have to go through the NICS check. So if it was taken away for either mental illness or commitment or something, it would hopefully it would have been reported to the NICS and they'd be prohibited. So, but I know the DNR has a huge gun auction, what, every few years, confiscated weapons and sells them this way and keeps the money in. I don't know. I don't think they've got a watch list or anything. They just sell them to whoever's qualified. So, okay. No other questions or comments. You heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Thank you, Representative Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next on the agenda is House File 955. Chair Cornish, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, so Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move as House File 955 be recommended to pass and go to Ways and Means.
Chair Cornish recommends House File 955 to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair and members, this has been heard before, and I think all the members here were present. This is the one in the omnibus bill we were talking about. It's moving the posting from the DOC to the BCA, and there was some controversy about it. We still haven't got a full fiscal note, and I know that DOC testified that there would be some problems and a cost, and BCA said they would welcome to have it there, but they were worried about funding, so we're in the process of sorting out the fiscal note. We're trying to figure out how, when you take duties away from somebody, there's an added cost. And when we were first told by BCA that they would absorb it, now they're coming up with the cost. So other than that, there's no problems with the bill. So, questions?
Any discussion? Representative Maury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, or Chair Cornish, is the DOC want to do this? They're the ones that set the levels. They're the ones that keep, they're responsible for where the people live. It seems really weird to have a different agency having the website posting from the one who sets the levels and is in charge of where these people live.
Representative Mulroy, no, they didn't want to do it. We wanted to do it, the authors, and we figure it's better to consolidate them on one website. It'd be better for the public to view it. The BCA, and the BCA said that they could accomplish that. And so, as far as I know, the
DOC wasn't in support of it.
What do you mean?
Representative Maury?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. What do you mean the consolidate them on one site?
Well, the BCA has already got a website, and for the non-compliant, and we wanted to move the people on the website from the DOC over to the BCA and take away that responsibility from them, so we could have both of those on one website.
Well, Representative Maury?
Mr. Chair, if you were going to have it on one website, it would seem that it should be at the Department of Corrections, which has is supposed to have control of these people. And the only reason that the BCA would have it would be for the few that they're trying to get, it would seem.
Chair Cornish?
I guess my only answer to that is, as we had the hearing before and all the testimony, and I did say that the DOC wasn't in support of it. I don't know how else to explain it to you. I think it's a good idea to have them all on one website at the BCA. They said they could do it, and that's the bill that's before you.
Representative Johnson.
Dennis. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just pretty much what Mullery said, it just doesn't make any sense. If the DOC is going to be doing the technical work, why would we, for a cost of money, send...
What's that? State again, please, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson.
I just said it. The bill doesn't seem to make any sense to me, since the DOC is going to be doing the technical work on the website. Is that correct?
Chair Cornish.
And it costs money to do this in the first place, so I'm just not clear. It's okay, not a convincing reason for why we're doing this, I guess.
The reason for doing this is we want the people on the public only have to go to one website and consolidate the service. And I guess I disagree, and we're going to find out in the fiscal note in the future as this moves along. I disagree with the fiscal note, how you can take away from, and it isn't a completed fiscal note, and until it is, I'd like to keep the bill progressing. I'd rather have, makes more sense to me to have one website for the public instead of two maintained by two different agencies. I think technically myself, it'll end up being a cost savings. But that'll be something to consider in the future.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hilty?
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, one question that occurs to me is that I presume there are members of the public and various agencies around the state that are accustomed to visiting the DOC website. Would it be necessary, if this is transferred, to maintain the DOC website and refer people to the BCA website? Or would the link that people are accustomed to following simply disappear at some point and then they wouldn't know what to do?
Chair Cornish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilda, I guess that's a matter of opinion. But the BCA is a popular website. It's easily obtainable, and they said that they could handle it. And I would think one website to go to would be a lot less confusing than two.
But, Representative Cornish, my question is, how would you contemplate people that are accustomed to using the current website becoming aware that it was going to disappear?
Well, I think that would be, with our internet capabilities, it'd be very easy to put the posting on with a new website. A matter of clicking a few buttons, I could probably even do it myself. It'd be like easy when you're gone from vacation and you put an auto reply message up. I mean, I think it's about that simple. Now, it's a matter of opinion, I guess, and IT people, I suppose. But like I say, I stipulate that the DOC is not in favor of doing this. It just seemed to be a good idea.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is a question for Mr. Carter, but I'm really confused by even the process of a fiscal note, because if we really are asking the department not to do something, now there's a cost to asking the department not to do something. Is there something I'm missing, Mr. Carter, or what are they even questioning?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, yes, it looks like, according to the fiscal notes, which is still a preliminary note, that public safety is saying they have a cost. I think there's one person and also some programming costs. The DOC is saying that because, you know, they still have to do some of these functions that, I think it's their testimony said it was split between several people, that they have they are showing no savings on this fiscal note. And maybe, you know, further, you know, there is somebody from DOC here in the audience, I know, that would testify to that.
I'm fine. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would think that now we're actually giving more responsibility to DOC because they have to keep track of all of these, and right now they can put it on their own website much easier than having to go through all the same stuff and then send it over there. So it would seem to me that they're actually ending up with more things, and I don't understand this at all, since DOC is going to have to continue doing all the stuff that they're already doing. Just doesn't make any sense.
Chair Corse, would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, I'd like to renew the motion of House File 955 be recommended to pass and move to Ways and Means.
Okay, Chair Cornish renews his motion that House File 955 be passed, recommend to pass, and be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Next on the docket is House File 738. Chair Cornish, would you like to move that bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 738 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
Chair Cornish, moves House File 738 and recommends to pass and be referred to the General Register. Chair Cornish, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, instead of me stumbling around, we did this once before. It was then heard, and I would like to have my testifier, Ms. Liz Richards, give the testimony on the why and the wherefores of the bill. And do we have an author's amendment here?
Is there an amendment on this?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment, I believe this is the friendly amendment offered by, is it Coalition? Is this the one? The Chair would offer the A1 amendment to get the bill in the proper form that he'd like.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we don't have the A1 amendment.
Oral amendment. Okay, so, all right. Thank you. Ms. Prius, could you?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be to House File 738, the first engrossment, on page 2.22, delete temporary. That actually applies to a different subdivision and so is incorrectly placed in this subdivision.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Chair Cornish, now the bill's in the manner in which you would like it.
If Ms. Richards, if turn it over to her and let her proceed.
Ms. Richards, can you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm here to just explain what this bill does. What the bill does is it proposes essentially two changes to the harassment restraining order, having to do with the violations of harassment restraining orders and how they may be prosecuted. And these changes are similar to modifications that were made in the stalking bill last year. The first has to do with if a violation, and sometimes what happens under harassment restraining orders is there's multiple violations that occur. And so if there are multiple violations that are being looked at to be prosecuted, that in that they occur in different counties, that any one county can prosecute all of the violations so that you wouldn't have to have separate prosecutions in multiple counties. So that's the first change that's being proposed. And the second change has to do with really addressing some technology issues and has to do with things like cell phone, email communications, to make it clear that violations made through those means can be prosecuted either in the county where the communication originates or where the communication is received, and add some clarity around how to interpret that in terms of communications such as email, where it may be a little bit difficult to determine exactly where communication was sent from or received. And so those are the changes that are being made in the statute, and this is just to provide some clarity so that we can actually get proper enforcement.
Thank you, Ms. Richard. Representative Maury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm wondering just a little bit, when we're dealing with criminal law, how would this affect somebody who sent something or called or did one of these from California, let's say?
Ms. Richards?
Chairman,
I'm just wondering a little bit, number one, can we prosecute them here? Number two, how would they... I guess it would seem there might be some problems with that, or somebody from out of the country or whatever. Can that apply?
Chairman, Representative.
Yes, Richards, go ahead.
Yeah. Under both case law and under the rules, that they do make it that you can with prosecute a crime either where the crime originates or where the crime occurs. And with crimes such as like mailing of letters, telephone calls, that those can be prosecuted either where the crime originates or where the crime where the communication is received. Both are considered to be places where the crime occurred. So so if you have a communication that originates from outside of the state and is received in the state of Minnesota, it's considered that the crime has been committed within the state of Minnesota. This just moves some of that clarification into the statute. It doesn't change what already exists under the rules and under the case law around criminal prosecution. And it really makes some clarity around electronic forms of communication.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Maury, go ahead.
So they could they be extradited for this then? Or?
Well, Ms. Richards?
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Extradition would still fall the same as it would under any crime.
Any other questions from members? Is there any? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Richards or Representative Cornish, could you explain the logic on line 2.25 and changing the language, striking that and adding another? It seems to me it's more clear the other way around.
Chair Cornish.
What, say again, the location?
It's 2.25. And changing from with that person to with another person.
Chair, Representative, I believe that when they were looking at the changes, it was just to make it consistent with the other provisions. I don't think it changes the any of the intent within it. If you look at under Subdivision 1, to avoid the harassment of another person, it's just paralleling that language throughout all the subdivisions.
But
Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, in this context, it seems that that would just be a broader definition. When you're talking about that person, you know for sure who you're talking about. But when you say another person, it doesn't necessarily imply that it's the person who was the subject of harassment.
Chair and Representative, I believe that the statute as it reads, like under Subdivision 1, where it uses the term another person, has always been in the statute since the harassment order was formed. I don't believe that there's been any instance in which the court has read that as anything other than the respondent, and I don't believe that that would be true for Subdivision 2 either, and it was just a matter of making consistent and parallel language throughout the subdivisions.
Any further questions from members? Any members of the public would like to speak in opposition or in support of the bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Cornish, or Chair Cornish, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to restate the motion. House File 738 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
Chair Cornish restates HF 738 as amended.
recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion is carried. The next on the calendar is House File 642.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 642, Evidence Slocum. Would some of your colleagues like to move your bill?
She couldn't.
Oh, you want to move it yourself?
Sure.
Okay. Sorry.
I moved it.
Sometimes we like to change it off of. Representative Slocum, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that 642 be passed, and I believe goes to the General Register.
Did you say 642?
I did.
Okay. The bill is before us. Representative Slocum, go ahead and present how you wish.
That's kind of, Mr. Chair, that's kind of a carte blanche. This bill you've seen before, and those of you who are on judiciary have seen it now twice. This is your third chance. It passed unanimously both in this committee and in judiciary before. What this bill allows is that a child certified as an adult can be detained in a juvenile facility. And the word, I guess I should use the word may be retained in a juvenile facility as opposed to an adult prison. The data shows that the less time a juvenile spends with an adult in prison, the better the outcome for that child. It's never good. There is no study that shows that it's good for a child to be in an adult facility. So this gives the option to have the child in a juvenile, held in a juvenile facility, even if they are certified to trial as an adult.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. I think we heard this before. I don't know of any opposition, and I think law enforcement was in support of it. Any questions?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. There is a letter, I believe, that is in your packet from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, from Jim Franklin, in support of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Are there any questions on the bill? If not, Representative Slocum, would you like to restate your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 642 be approved and go to the General Register.
Okay, you folks have heard the motion. Any comments or questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Slocum. Good bill. Now we have House File 1478, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Hilty, would you like to move House File 1478?
I would, Mr. Chair. Not sure.
Judiciary?
Very well, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1478 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. And Representative Kiffmeyer, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Appreciate your time today to hear a very important bill. This is an agency bill. They are here with me today. I'm also very pleased that this is a bill that has bipartisan support, because this is an issue that all of us care about and want to make sure that in this very sensitive area that we protect the people, but also make sure that it is done in a way that is cost-effective and efficient in its processing. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would allow the agency to present and give testimony as to the merits of the bill and to explain any issues that they that you may have questions on, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I believe it's a non-controversial agency bill, so if we could keep the testimony short, that would be great. Go ahead. State your name and title.
Good morning. My name is Sheila Brandt, and I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Before my colleague gets to the actual articles of the bill, I would also just like to thank the committee for their time this morning. One, there is a correction on the information sheet that you have. I believe it does not list a Senate file number, and this is being moved in the Senate as well by Senator Hahn, with the bill number being 1287. The other thing I'd like to say about this is the critical nature that Representative Kiffmeyer has already presented to you is that the two primary things that this bill will address is, one, to reform and create efficiencies in our program and some aspects of the civil commitment process, and most importantly for this committee is to ensure safe, coordinated, and efficient community reintegration for our clients when the court orders a provisional discharge.
Okay, sir, your name and title, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I'm a legal manager with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and I will do a walkthrough, or rather a skip through, of the bill language. It's organized by articles. Those articles are group things by kind of like items, so that's the focus that I will do. The first article is Article 1, Transfers and Readmissions. That article expands the existing procedures for voluntary readmission to a secure facility for a civilly committed sex offender who has been transferred or provisionally discharged. It also adapts the existing revocation procedures to transfers. Article 2, titled Absent Without Authorization, strengthens and clarifies the state agency and law enforcement authority and roles in apprehending and returning a civilly committed sex offender who is absent without authorization. Article 2 also ensures that the current felony escape statute covers all Minnesota sex offender program clients in all situations. Article 3, titled Commitment Procedure, Article 3 streamlines the sexually dangerous person and sexual psychopathic personality commitment procedures to a single hearing instead of two. Article 4, regarding community notification, ensures that public notification of the broadest scope available under the law is used when a civilly committed sex offender is going to reside in the community. Article 5 is a technical correction regarding parties to the petition before the Judicial Appeal Panel. Article 6, Sex Offender Civil Commitment Statutes, directs the Department of Human Services to work with the Revisor's Office to develop legislation next session to reorganize sex offender civil commitment statutes so that they are clear and distinguished from statutes that pertain to other civil commitment categories. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Questions from members? Any other testimony from anybody else in support or opposition in the crowd? And I'll come back to Representative Moran. Doesn't look like it. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. In the community notification, does the department work to ensure that the person who's re-entering the community is not in the same vicinity as the victim?
Ma'am, go ahead. Ms. Brandt?
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative Moran. When we're working with someone to do a community reintegration replacement, that would be important. First of all, our folks who are identified as victims would be notified about the status of this individual and where they're at in the commitment process. We are not targeting any one specific county. MSOP is taking the stance that we are looking to all counties, all parts of the state, because sexual violence is a statewide program. So we are looking to the county of best fit. Obviously, knowing that someone's victim, if that's known to us, is in a specific area, that would probably fall down the list of best fit categories.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, I would restate the motion for... Yes, Representative Hilty, would you like to restate your motion? Sorry about that.
I would, Mr. Chair, move that House File 1478 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
OK, Okay, you folks have heard the motion. Any comments, questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, all right, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Biskins, do you want to go now? And you got anywhere to go, or do you want to? All right, come on down. Then Representative Hortman will take you right after that. Okay, Representative Biskins has House File 615. The chair would move House File 615 be recommended to pass and move to, is it Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Did they ask for it? Okay. Mr. Carter? Well.
Mr. Chair, it should go to Ways and Means because there is a fiscal note for the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask just an inquiry of staff, the fiscal note is zero, though. Does it still need to go to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the fiscal note that we have on 615, I guess we have the old fiscal note. Okay, it is zero, okay, I see. We have the second one. It's my understanding because there's still some funding involved.
Sure.
It
sure.
Still has to go to Ways and Means, but we can.
Yeah, no problem, Mr. Chairman. I would approve of that motion.
Okay, then the chair would move House File 615 be recommended to pass and go to Ways and Means. Mr. Representative Biskins, it's in front of us. Go ahead and present.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 615 looks to move our driver's ed instruction program into the 21st century by allowing driver's ed instruction, the classroom portion, to be as an option for students and families to be taken via internet offering. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are no other changes in the driver's ed program, no curriculum changes, no changes in how students are tested so as to receive their permit. The only change we're seeking is to allow the instruction to be taken via the internet. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as a 28-year educator and as a person who sat side by side with Senator Steve Kelly in bringing online learning into our K-12 systems, you're going to hear from a number of people who see this as a big, scary thing, and I understand that. For some, it's a matter of jobs for adults, and that's appreciated. Education Minnesota will probably come forward and say they oppose this, and that's appreciated. I mean, I would expect nothing less from a teachers union, all right? But all of the boogeymen in the closet that were brought out when Senator Kelly and I talked and introduced online learning into the K-12 system, you're going to hear repeated again, but they haven't borne out. For some students, not a lot, but for some, this is a very good way of receiving education. And members of the committee, I wish Representative Simon, because we make a good partnership, he sat next to me in the Transportation Committee because he's carried this legislation for the past couple of years, and he would have loved to have been here today to speak in support of this as well. But this is not a new concept. It's been before the legislature before, and in fact, the legislature's last time it was in front of us said, we ought to study this first. All right, let's see what's happening because there are other states that already offer this. Let's give money to the Department of Public Safety to actually study what's happening in other states. And members, they did. All right. Now, I'm never one real big on governmental studies because I think a lot of times it just gets put in the shelf. All right. But here's one. Maybe we should not have put in the shelf. All right. I did in your packets. You should see the cover that looks like this. plus the conclusion on the back side of the cover that looks like this. And the conclusion is, and I will quote, upon examining internet-based programs in 12 states, DPS found no evidence to date indicating whether teens who receive internet-based instruction are more or less likely to commit traffic violations or be involved in crashes. In other words, it's just another option, one that can be more family-friendly for some people, one that some parents would say, never in the world would I let my child take their driver's instruction via internet. That's fine. All right. No mandates, just another option. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd appreciate your support.
Okay, before we take questions, I just wanted to ask if there's anybody else in support or not for you to testify with you. No other testifiers for you?
Mr. Chair, I thought I would, but they don't seem to have been here. But I will tell you that for members of the committee, I have worked with DPS in crafting this bill. They're comfortable with it going forward. I've worked with AAA. They're not only comfortable, they support the bill. All right? So that's I'm here.
Okay, and anybody in the crowd wishing to testify in opposition, you should come down and get in the front row and be ready to go. And Representative Slocum, you want to ask now, or do we want to wait for the...
No, I'll wait.
Okay, Representative Mallory, did you want to ask
maybe
now?
Maybe just quickly. And I'm trying to read through here. I noticed that if a person is homeschooled, then they can do it at home. Does the internet have to be in a classroom if they're not officially a homeschooled student full-time?
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, no. It does not have to be in a classroom. And to answer that, and here is why one of the reasons this legislation does not go to K-12, because instruction in driver's ed is that instruction is monitored by DPS. It is not a Department of Education instruction. In fact, one of the interesting caveats is anyone sitting here can become a driver's ed classroom instructor, and one of the ways you can become an instructor is to complete an online instructor's course.
Representative Mallory.
I'm just
pretty credible.
I haven't looked into this before, so it's really just open-ended questions. I have no idea.
Oh, that's fine.
So, right now, you have to have courses in like a classroom setting. And I'm just going to go through this, and then you tell me at the end what is correct, what isn't. You have to do classroom setting. You have to do behind the wheel. This would apparently allow anybody to do the classroom part of it by internet, either in a classroom or if I'm a student at Patrick Henry, I can do it at my own home, even though I'm not a homeschooled student. Is that correct?
Or? Representative Biskins.
Yeah, Representative Mallory, that is correct. Just as if you are a student at Patrick Henry and decide you want to go down to Safeway driving school and take your course.
Or take it at Patrick Henry in a classroom.
Or Patrick Henry, yeah, those options exist.
Okay, no more questions on the list here. The first on the list we've got here is Charles Chip Hasten from the Safeway Driving School. If you want to state your name and title and go ahead with your presentation. Can you keep it for a few minutes or?
Yeah, I can.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chip Hasten, and I'm the owner of Safeway Driving School. Just as way of background, Safeway has been educating teens for 42 years in the Twin Cities. Last year we did 4,000 students, and we do that through 13 classrooms and community ed programs across the metro area. I know I'm on the agenda as an opposer of this bill, but that's not really a fair characterization of my view. I completely agree that teens learn differently from each other. People ought to be able to have the option, the convenient, flexible option of going online to take driver's ed. For heaven's sake, high school students today can take dozens of courses online, and there's no reason in the world why driver's ed can't be one of them. But I do have some concerns about this bill. One other I want to mention to you is that there are 1,300 classroom instructors in the state right now. And if this bill passes, there is the possibility that they won't be classroom instructors anymore. Indiana had online driver's ed 18 months ago, and their estimate is that about half the students are now taking the online course, which means half of their instructors are no longer teaching the classroom. I mention this not because I think you ought to vote against the bill because jobs are at stake, but I think it would be too bad if that fact just weren't mentioned for your consideration. I'm concerned about this misconception that since driver's ed instructors can take a course online, drivers, teens should be able to do the same thing. Very different programs. The online course offered by St. Cloud State is one where people connect to the classroom, in effect via cable TV, on their internet. Attendance is taken. Instructor leads it. Questions get asked and answered. It's a teacher-led course. What's being proposed would not be a teacher-led course. As members of the Public Safety Committee, you're aware of the statistics regarding teen crashes as well as I am. Teens crash at two or three times the rate of the rest of us, and I won't belabor that. And we know why the crash rate is so high. In fact, the study that was just cited to you talks about why it is. It's not, by the way, because students don't know if you're supposed to stop behind a school bus with flashing red lights at 20 feet versus 25 feet. That's what the permit test tests. That's not why kids have crashes. They have crashes because, and I'm quoting from the study, because they're immature, they have a high propensity for risk-taking behavior, they have an illusion of invulnerability, they don't recognize hazards, and they have deficient decision-making. I'm not disparaging our teens. I'm simply quoting from one of a number of studies that all say the same thing. Knowing this, Minnesota has long required 30 hours of classroom instruction, even though the 40-question permit test, in order to get a driver's license, can be taught in just 5 hours. The national standards, by the way, call for 45 hours of classroom. Why so much? Well, it's because classroom time allows teachers to focus on attitude, behavior, and judgment. Those are the things that turn a knowledgeable driver into a safe driver. And those are the things that I believe a self-directed online course is least likely to impact. Some would have you believe that clicking through 1,000 slides for 30 hours, looking at some animation, watching a few videos, taking some quizzes is just as likely to impact a teen's attitude, behavior, and judgment as a teacher-led class, that the impact of a live in-person presentation by a teacher can be duplicated by an online course. Well, that just can't be true. I mean, here I am in person, looking at you in the eye to make sure I've got your attention, pausing to let my point sink in, gesturing with my hands for emphasis, using props for credibility, answering your questions, and if this forum allowed for it, I'd be directing a discussion as well. I'm here in person because I want to change your attitude. I want to influence your decision, just like a driver's ed teacher. Minnesota knows that this isn't true as well, which is why we already have statutes, they were cited earlier, related to online education, statutes that require that online classes be teacher-led. The proponents of this bill want driver's education to be exempt from these statutes. That's right, high school students can currently take dozens of English, math, science, history, language courses already, all of them teacher-led, all offering convenience, flexibility, different learning styles, modern technology, and all teacher-led, except for one course, driver's education, the one course that can get them killed that will be exempt. And I have yet to hear why. I think there's a solution, though. I've distributed to all of you, I think, a proposed amendment to this House File 615 that makes it clear that you mean a teacher-led online class. The amendment essentially replaces the words, quote, internet-based theory driver education program, that's the online industry's terminology, with teacher-led online learning program. My language comes out of Minnesota Statutes 124D.095, which deals with online learning.
Mr. Heiss?
Yeah.
If you could just shorten up a little bit, but I'm sorry, unfortunately, I can't accept the amendment. It didn't make the 24-hour rule, and isn't
okay.
It real
I understand
form.
That what I'm...
But
what
we
I'm,
have another stop at Ways and Means, or, okay. You know, it just you have to be in time. And go ahead, sir.
That's fine. I'll be brief at the end here. What do our statutes say is an online learning program? I quote from the statutes, an interactive course or program that delivers instructions from a teacher to a student by the computer. I believe a change like this will address address both the convenience of online driver's education and the impact of being teacher-led. It will reflect Minnesota standards for online education, and it is a change supported by the Minnesota Driver and Traffic Safety Association, Education Association called MTSEA. That's the Association of Public School Driver's Ed Teachers, and the Minnesota Driving School Association, which you'll hear from briefly after me. That's the Commercial School Association. And I urge you to consider modifying the bill to reflect that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. Any questions from the testifier? Representative Mulroy? We've got Representative Grunhagen and then Representative Mulroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is your last name Tyson?
It's spelled that way, but it's pronounced Tyson.
Tyson, okay. Thank you for your testimony. Just a couple of things from my perspective is I own insurance agents. Independent insurance agency. I've sold health or insurance for almost 30 years, competitive insurance. You know, when I look at this and I look at my own situation, when internet sales of life insurance, let's just say, came on or other types of insurance, a lot of agents said, oh, we're going to be put out of business, okay? Then there was the advertisement of life insurance. I started out as a life and health insurance agent, and now I have a full-line agency. But, oh, we're all going to be put out of business because people call in on a toll-free number and apply for life insurance. You know, and yet what I did, rather than complain about it, I tried to be a better agent. So if the things you're saying are true about the concern that by becoming better and getting your message out, I believe in the wisdom of the consumer, okay? And in the free market, when you're allowed on an equal playing field to get your message out, you will bring those customers in, and people will realize over a period of time that you provide a better service and product for their child than the internet action does. But to try to keep competition out, okay, I find in my 30-some years of experience, allows the people who provide a particular service, and I'm not, you know, to get comfortable and be less competitive than when you introduce competition. And all of us want this, and I'm not saying I'm any different. We like this security. We like to build ourselves into a situation where we're secure. But what I find is, especially economically, but what I find is we operate best in life when we have a certain level of insecurity. And that means competition. And none of us like that. You know, I don't like the type of competition I get locally. Although they're taking my policy away, they're trying to take my customers. But it makes me a better agent. So I don't see that, you know, I don't see that what Representative Biskins is bringing forward, it's just giving people an additional option, and I think the marketplace will sort out the good from the bad, and ultimately, if everything you said about the concerns that you're, that the extra benefits you bring, the wisdom of the of the consumer will sort that out in the marketplace. You know, I tend to identify with Milton Friedman on that, okay? So, anyway, I could go on this, and I should cut it off short. But anyway, that's just the perspective of why I'm going to support the bill.
Sir, could you hold your thoughts? We're going to have to recess just long enough to get to room 200. And as soon as we get them a quorum, we'll probably start again. I was going to say at noon, but I think we can get there before that. So let's move to room 200, and as soon as we get a quorum, if somebody's coming into this room, then we'll start right up and continue your bill.
And order again. Order, order. The continuation of our meeting from room 10 now moved to room 200. And I know. I think we are at the finish of your basic testimony and answering questions now, all right, sir? Representative Mulroy here, he had the next one. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
May I respond to that comment?
Very shortly. Shortly. I mean, go ahead, but just make it a short answer.
Yeah. If any of you think that the reason that I think this bill ought to be modified is because I'm afraid of competition,
I must have said something wrong. I'm completely in favor of introducing online education to the state of Minnesota. I'm simply saying that let's not exempt it from our existing statutes on what online learning looks like. That's all.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Representative Biskins, was there anybody else to testify in opposition?
Yes, there are. Right here.
This gentleman, Jim. Okay, sir, you would take the table. She state your name and title and go ahead.
My name is James Steins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Driving School Association, which is a volunteer position. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, and I'll try and make it as brief as possible. I am going to read from my notes because I'm a lot better at speaking standing up, walking back and forth, or outside your car window, as being that I am a licensed peace officer in the state of Minnesota, and I actively work as a deputy sheriff. I've been involved in the driving school industry for about 10 years. The member schools of the association are adamantly opposed to allowing teens this option of an unguided internet driver's education option. And it's strictly founded in safety. It's not founded in our jobs or in our businesses. Driving a car isn't inherently difficult. It doesn't take a remarkable athletic prowess or mental acuity. It doesn't take a great deal of intelligence. Driving a car, I really truly believe, is about 10% skill and knowledge, 90% attitude. The things we see going bad on the road isn't a skill-based issue. It's an attitude-based issue. And attitudes are not molded through a static learning of material. They're molded through relationships and shared experiences. The majority of our classroom times are not spent focusing on the permit test. The permit test is 40 questions. I'm often, if I'm in front of students or if I'm in front of a group of parents on a parent seminar, I'll hold up a Minnesota driver's manual and I say, you could study this for anywhere from 0 to 6 hours, go in and pass the permit test. It's that easy. It's not about passing the permit test, our classroom isn't. It's about the what-ifs, the whens, and the attitude shift, that paradigm shift that young people, especially young men, need. A lot better if I would just stay to these things. The most powerful teaching moments in a classroom are where local stories are shared. Instructors share personal experiences, and most powerful yet is when students tell of their own experiences and that of their family members. Most often these teaching times is when a young man, usually a young man, sitting in that back corner that's been sloughed back, head on sideways, all of a sudden sits up and takes notice and begins to become engaged. As a teacher, you see the light go on, and that maybe they just heard something that's going to save their life. Maybe all of a sudden they became engaged. It's just not about seat time. Most teens are uncomfortable asking questions for looking stupid in front of their peers. But there's always a few brave ones, and those few brave ones ask questions and get answers that help everybody else in that class. And through these questions and answers, more a lot of times jump in and will ask questions. And this is where that shared learning experience takes place. Again, this is where attitudes are molded. Skill, the manual is way too easy. The permit test is not a gauge. I'd like you to think of the unintended consequences for a minute. For example, it's now illegal to text and drive, right? That was a law that was probably greatly looked at as being a no-brainer. But would you be surprised now that we have now an increased danger of crashes because of our texting law? When it was legal for people to drive, they would text like this, their hand up, phone right in front of them, right in line of sight. Now that it's illegal to text, they're doing it down here, where their eyes are not on the road. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety released a report in September 28th of 2010 entitled, Texting Bans Don't Reduce Crashes. Effects are a slight increase. Within that report, Minnesota shows a 9% increase in crashes. The unintended consequences, members and chairman, are what we have to think about. I've spoken with numerous school instructors from other states where this type of learning, this static learning process where there's no teacher involvement with the student, which is what we're discussing, approving here, is already law. They told us that online students are far less prepared for the behind-the-wheel lessons than their traditional classroom students. That's because they have to teach them their methods, their terminology. The behind-the-wheel lessons are much less effective. We only get 6 hours with these kids trying to coach them. That's it. We get 6 hours. That's far short of even what the national standards show. The results of a substantial portion of these 6 hours are reviewing terminology rather than actually practicing what the behind-the-wheel skills should be. Again, when we test basic knowledge, that 0 to 6 hours of learning a manual. When we test for the road test, we're just testing basic driving skills. Those are not good evaluation tools whether or not attitudes have been changed. Until we have long-term look at crash results, which there isn't that information out there, we don't know. And that's why the report says there's no information supporting or denying that this mode of education is more or less effective. That report line cuts both ways.
Sir, how much time you get?
Can you give me about 3 minutes?
At the max.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Maybe one.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you're not appreciating my
we are appreciated very much. It's just that it's Friday and we got another bill that might be somewhat controversial right after yours. So.
Okay. I would say that proponents argue that this is more convenient, and they're correct. I would argue that safety requires convenience. It's more convenient to drive home after having a few drinks at the bar. It's more convenient it is more convenient to drive home than to get a cab or get a friend. It's more convenient, it isn't convenient to strap your four-year-old into a booster seat. Safety requires inconvenience sometimes. Parents spend a lot of time driving their kids back and forth for other things. I'd like to just close with the fact that we have not re-asked for this support, but in the past, the Minnesota police chiefs and the sheriff's organizations both have opposed this same bill. The Minnesota Insurance Institute or Association opposed this bill, along with the Trucking Association opposed this bill. The last three things, let me just real briefly here. Who is the most likely to take this easy out option? Is it the happy, engage, follow the rules teen? Or is it the I know everything, rules are stupid, I just need to get through it teen? The latter example is the one who most needs that interaction and that attitude shift with an instructor. Second, unlike the texting laws that regular folks think was a good idea, this bill gives very strong pushback from common people that have teens or knows teens when they hear about it. The most common response is, that's not very smart, or a variant thereof. We know that the unintended consequences of increased crashes from a well-supported law. The unknown is the unintended consequences we'll face from this law. Lastly, I'd like to close by acknowledging that many courses are taught over the internet to high school students. I applaud how Minnesota does it. I applaud the authors working towards making sure that it's teacher-led. Why are we doing this one not teacher-led? A teacher-led option would be totally supported by my organization. I ask you just to consider our kids, consider our driving public, and vote no at this time in the way that this is currently written.
Thank you, sir. Representative Mullery.
Thank
Representative
you.
Mullery, I really appreciate you sitting on the right. Now I can tell everybody you're even further to the right than I am.
I'm over.
Well, remember, Mr. Chairman, when you were setting it up initially, I said I thought you would take the position down here because so that you were at the extreme right rather than in the normal in the middle. Just one quick question. When we have online learning courses in high schools or for high school courses, aren't they always in like an education classroom or something like that rather than letting the kids say, yeah, I'm going to watch that tonight? And I guess I don't know who this is for, but just that's a question for me.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Biscus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mowry, if you are in the public education system yet, there would be teacher-led. If you are a homeschool student, I'm going to go home and watch it at night. All right, so both options are available to our students. And members, understand this. If we put in a teacher-led caveat, there's no need for the bill, because you can have these courses right now with teachers running an online curriculum. There's nothing in law that would prevent that. Teacher-led kills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick follow-up. How do we get them to make sure the kids actually watch the courses?
You asking me?
Whoever.
Representative Biscus, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the online technology exists that does provide some level of assurance. I mean, you've got major and prestigious universities that allow for some of their courses to be taken online. There are those safeguards. And, of course, the most important safeguard is, the end of the day, a child who is going to pay the money and go through this does so because they want to pass the test.
Representative Moore? Okay, Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some personal experience with this, so I wanted to just put my 2 cents worth in. Both my children use the online learning course in California. They went through it. I think the courseware that's out there today is superior. It forces you to go through every module. And it takes tests at the end of the module and tests at the end. Of course, there's great out there. My kids, they drive to L.A. and to San Diego. There's 20 million people down there. There's 6-lane highways. They do a great job. And I'm a supporter of this bill. So I signed on early. I was actually quite surprised that we didn't already have this. And remember that this is just an option. We're just opening this up as an option for parents to, homeschool kids, or in my case, we just never could get the kids to a classroom on Saturday. They don't have it in schools out there, and of course, we don't do that in schools here now anymore. So it's a great option. That's all it is.
Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo a lot of what Representative Leidiger said, and also I appreciate your comments about attitudes of teens, but I have two that are in college now, so I've gone through the driver's ed thing, thankfully. And, if my child, if I knew it was that kind of a stubborn kid who needed some outside authority, I think it's a parental choice, and I would probably force them to go into the classroom situation with you or some other teacher. But I think I could see it as kind of a helpful tool for people who might live in rural areas where it is hard to get to a group setting or get there on Saturday, like you said. And the schools don't offer it for free anymore. It's a cost. So just the...
Chairman, can I respond?
Just a second. We got another...
I'm sorry.
Unless they ask you a question, we usually close the testimony. Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief. Thank you, Representative Biskins, for bringing this forward. I supported it with Simon also. Mm-hmm. Online learning is an exciting way for kids to be engaged in their learning, and quality online classes should be. Kids take them for English, for math, for all the different classes. I don't know why they shouldn't for driver's ed.
Don't have any other members questions. We got another testifier.
You're welcome.
You want to go ahead and state your name and title and go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. And I will try to be very brief and not repeat things I had included in my original testimony that have already been stated. We do share some of the concerns that the previous testifiers have mentioned about safety. So I just want to make a couple points for you. First of all, I would like us to really stop and think about who we are talking about in this bill. We are talking about, as I would say, as a mother, kids, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, and how they will do out on the roads if they're not prepared, not only for their safety, but for the safety of others. The other thing I think we need to realize that these changes could potentially bring about is that it is possible that someone else could actually take the test for these students. And that hasn't been raised yet, but I think it's an important point for you to consider when you're thinking about this bill. We are mostly concerned about the quality of instruction. And as the previous testifier stated, in a classroom setting, the student comes in and can talk about real life issues. And I think that that cannot be replaced with online. I think that's essential for these kids to be able to talk about that with an actual teacher. Representative Biskins had mentioned the Department of Public Safety study that had been done, and I too want to point out something that is in that study, and that is what does contribute to teen crashes. It was mentioned, but I think it's worth repeating. Immaturity, the lack of driving experience, high propensity for risk-taking, deficient decision-making, and again, these are not things that can be addressed in online, but they can be in a classroom setting. We do not support this bill. I would like to add a personal note, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm very passionate about this. I have personally lost a father and two brothers to vehicle-related accidents. And I would just leave you with public safety trumps convenience or anything else that you think this bill will do. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Representative McDonald, do you have a question?
I do not.
Oh, okay. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier. I'm not quite sure. I'm thinking back when I took my driver's ed half a century ago or so. I'm not quite sure how a limited classroom is going to change my adolescent behavior risk-taking. I just don't buy it. I'm not going to support the bill, but I think it's a false argument that you have.
Mr. Chair, committee members.
Go ahead.
Not sure what was the question, Representative.
Can you make a short answer, please?
Yes, I will. That was something found in the study by the department that I just referenced, and I do think that those characteristics, kind of in general, were things that I was trying to make the point that can be addressed and at least discussed in a classroom setting versus online. Thank you.
Representative Priestel.
Kind of to echo Representative Gauthier's concerns with that argument, we're kind of focusing on a very small group of knuckleheads, cheaters, kids with bad attitudes. I use the word knuckleheads, I know you don't. A six-hour class isn't going to change that. And those kids, if they go through the six-hour class in the classroom and then go out and pass their test, they might be the ones that are going to crash anyway, or they're going to, you can't stop that with a six-hour class. And I think we're getting awfully hung up on a small group of people that you can't change regardless. So,
okay. I don't see any other questions here. Do you want to make a short closing statement, Representative Biskins? It looks like you have a fairly popular bill here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Number one, to clarify the statement that somebody can take the test for another student, we're not changing the testing environment, test location. You still got to go down to the testing station, sit at the computer, and take the test. That doesn't change, no matter what kind of instruction you have. We heard associations that oppose this bill, and I know you had a bill a little earlier this week, Mr. Chairman, where you heard associations oppose it, and yet individuals who belong to that association supported a piece of legislation that was heard. That's exactly the same is true here. In fact, in transportation, we had a gal named Debbie Prudhomme, who is owner of a driver's program, local owner, who supports this and does see, as I think it is Representative Grunhagen said, a new business model that they could fit in. The testifier said as a mother she would have grave concerns. Well, if she has grave concerns, then as a mother I'm sure her child will be taking a classroom online instruction, and or a classroom instruction, not an online instruction, and we're keeping those options open, of course. Finally, you know, this bill has broad bipartisan support. I already mentioned Representative Simon. Thank you, Representative Slocum. Representative Weidiger, Representative Hausman has co-authored the bill. Representative Beard is a co-author of this bill. Members, again, I thank you. It's time to move into the 21st century, and I'd appreciate your support.
Okay. I had to editorialize somebody else's bill, but Jim, the testifier that was up, we realize you're passionate about this and have some deep thoughts about it, but this fast-pacing, changing world here, I think, is kind of changing things on the online versus you know, in the classroom. So, but we do appreciate your testimony. With that, with no more questions, Representative Biskin's bill, House File 615, the chair will move it, recommended to pass, and move to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. And House File 1214, our last bill, and we remember when this bill is over, we're released, some of us anyway, for the weekend, so keep that in the back of your mind as we belabor the questions. Representative Portman, would somebody like to move Representative Johnson, go ahead. Oh, okay. 1214. Representative Johnson moves House File 1214 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. And Representative Hortman, go ahead. Good to see you. Your bill.
Nice to see you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be quick. In 2009, we passed a Minnesota Child Passenger Restraint Bill. And what that bill required was that children who would have a proper restraint up to either age 8 or when they reach 4'9". And in either case, when they reach that threshold, they would be out of the booster seat. The law applied to all passenger vehicles. And what it only requires is that if the seat has a belt that's installed in it, then that's where you use a booster seat. If there's no belt, there's no requirement to use a booster seat. The law took effect July 1st, 2009. We were able to access $378,000 in federal money. In 2010, we were approached by school bus advocates to pass a school bus exemption, and we did that. The problem was the federal government didn't like that, and it said we couldn't get the $378,000 anymore because they did not like the way that our exemption for the school buses was drafted. So what we are seeking to do here is to clarify the law in 2011 to make us re-eligible for that $378,000. And it's really a technical change in terms of definition. The federal government deals with definitions of school buses in a different way than Minnesota law. It's kind of one's Greek and one's Latin. They're both equally difficult to understand. We're not trying to change what the law does. We're trying to get back into the situation where we can access the federal dollars.
Okay, thank you, Representative Portman. And if there's no question, we'll move to the next testifier. Cherie Marty, go ahead, state your name and title, and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Cherie Marty, Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with DPS. I think Representative Hortman did a very nice job of just kind of giving you the overview. So in the interest of time, I think I would just entertain any questions.
Okay, if there's no questions, I believe we have a testifier in opposition. It would be Valerie, is it Dosland or Dosland? If you really call it opposition or amendment, or but go ahead and state your name and title in the correct way and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, and we represent about 300 licensed child care centers around the state of Minnesota. And while we understand the department's concern and the department's concern for the loss of federal funds, we have concerns about House File 1214. One of the many responsibilities of licensed child care centers is to transport school-aged children to and from school, and also to transport them to school or to activities during the school breaks. We transport children in vehicles defined by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as multifunction school activity buses. These buses comply with all federal motor vehicle safety standards relative to construction, vehicle crash safety, integrity, occupant seating, crash protection, driver visibility, and compartmentalization. And the multifunctioning school activity buses have installed, most of them, the newer ones especially, have installed seat belts, and most of them have lap belts. While many multifunction activity buses may be over 10,000 pounds, the buses that our centers use around Minnesota typically range between 9,600 to 9,900 pounds. Thus our concerns of the bill, because the language in House File 1214 only allows for an exemption for buses that are over 10,000 pounds. We are concerned about this proposed legislation because we always want to make sure our children are transported safely, and we believe that our buses meet federal safety requirements. We're concerned that because we're under 10,000 pounds, we don't have the exemption, and while our buses have lap belts, you cannot use booster seats with lap belts. It's not safe to do that. And as a result, our centers will have to make one of two choices. The first one is they stop transporting school-age kids to and from school, which brings a greater burden to families who work. Or our other option would be to completely retrofit the interiors with the buses, or to either retrofit the existing seats, which is about 2,000, but those seat belts, restraints tend to look more like straitjackets, and kids tend to not feel comfortable in those. Or the other option is to completely take out the seats and put in new seats that have the appropriate lap and shoulder belts to be able to use for the buses. And again, I want to emphasize that our child care providers want to assure that we are transporting kids as safely as possible, and that we are using buses that meet federal safety requirements and compartmentalization requirements. And in addition, our staff in licensed centers follow the same training requirements about bus safety as children riding in the typical yellow school buses. And we always strive to make sure our teachers who are transporting kids meet all of the requirements of state law. And again, while we understand the concerns about the loss of federal money, this will have a significant impact either on the families who send their kids to child care centers or on the fiscal cost of centers alone. And I'm available for any questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Leifer.
Thank you, sir. How do the daycare centers transport the kids right now?
You'll see in your community for a licensed center, they have a multifunction activity bus, which is a white bus. It's painted white, and it has the signage that says child care buses. They are not allowed to have the lights or a stop arm vehicle, and there's actually a special section in state law that designates what a child care bus must look like. There may be some centers that might still have a 15-passenger van, but the federal government has said that dealers cannot sell new vans to licensed centers. So for the most part, most licensed centers don't. They use these buses, and I have a picture. I can pass it around.
Mr. Chairman, can I?
What
about on the seat belts? You just use the regular seat belts then inside?
There's lap belts.
The dozen.
Just regular lap belts.
There's lap belts. The newer buses come with shoulder restraints, and I would certainly defer to the Department of Public Safety, but I believe starting after October 2011, they'll be coming with the shoulder. They'll be manufactured with the shoulder restraints. But I, again, would defer to public safety on that.
I'm just a little confused on this. So that's the way they're doing it now. The way it comes manufactured, the way the buses come manufactured with the lap belts, but with this bill, it's going to force you to upgrade to bigger belts or different seats. Can you just explain that real quick again?
Mr. Chair, You cannot use, it's unsafe to use a booster seat with just a lap belt. You have to have a shoulder or chest restraint system.
Representative Hortman, can you shed some light on this?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. The problem with our the testimony right now from the daycare providers is I just learned this morning of their concerns about the bill. And they have a completely different reading, and with all due respect, I don't think they understand the child passenger restraint system and its interplay with those vehicles and the exemption that we passed. I think we can get to peace in the valley, but this is complicated because of the Greek and the Latin issue with between federal law and state law and the way the language works. But the child passenger restraint legislation does not require any retrofitting of any vehicle. What we reference is the federal safety standards, and you're not required to use a booster seat where there's a lap-only belt because it's more unsafe to use a booster seat when there's a lap-only belt than to just put the child in the lap belt. So the booster seats are only required where there's already the proper restraints installed in the vehicle to use with the booster seat. So the bill never will require any retrofitting, but I think we've got to work through these issues with the professionals from the Department of Public Safety who understand both the Greek of the state regulations and how we define school buses and type 3 vehicles, and the Latin of the federal, where they really rely a lot on poundage and compartment strength.
At this point, I agree with Representative Hortman, and maybe they come to some clarification here in the future. But any more questions? No other testimony in the public? Representative Grunhagen, you got 8 seconds. No, I just... Yeah. Go ahead.
That's more than my wife gives me. Now, the is this bill going to the register?
This bill is going to general register, yes. General Register.
It is. Yes. I mean, can these problems be resolved before it gets to the...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
I believe so, yes.
I think so.
Oh, hi. Come on up.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman and members, I will be really brief since I know I'm the last one between you and your weekend. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the School Boards Association. And though we really appreciate Representative Portman's work on this area, this brings forward a sort of case study of the problem that's going on between public safety and school districts around the state. This bill was enacted in 2009 to have these seats. We repealed it last year, so school districts had booster seats. Then we got rid of them, and now we will be required to have them once again. And the safety is really something we're committed to also. But it's going to make us in our small communities go back out and buy new booster seats. The reason is that DPS wants to apply for a federal grant. That grant's about $400,000. That's not a purpose that can help school districts pay for these booster seats. So your local folks and your local districts are going to have to conform to this change. And the benefit of doing this change will come to DPS. I also suggest to you that we have the Office of School, I want to make sure I get the language here, Office of School Transportation Safety, which is statutorily staffed by 19 individuals through DPS. Their charge is to work with the stakeholders, which would be Valerie and I, and come up with solutions as we go forward. That's not what's happened with this bill. They brought it up here, so now, it leaves us in a position where we're going to end up going back to our members and saying, hey, the one thing you finally got because we worked on it a year than the year before, well, now it's back and forth. And this is a piece of real frustration, and I hope members don't solely focus on Representative Portman's bill, but look much more at the bigger picture, that these are federal laws triggering local impacts, sort of a hodgepodge way, and we have case law and statutory reference that DPS should be helping us transition from one to another and provide leadership, and that just really hasn't happened, and it's a big source of frustration since we are all committed to making kids safe. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll answer any questions if needed.
Okay, any questions from members? Seeing none. Any closing remarks, Representative Portman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that I think we could probably work on that issue, too. It's obviously a different issue that relates to the relationship between the Department of Public Safety and school transportation officials. And I think maybe this bill gives me an opportunity to be a part of those conversations to create more peace in the Valley. But, Mr. Chair, that's a separate issue from this bill, but we will work on that.
So are you done then?
Yeah.
I think we're ready to vote.
Okay, the chair, let's see, Representative Johnson will restate his motion to move House File 1214 be recommended to pass and move to the general register. Is any comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. Then the next meeting will be Wednesday, May 4th at 10:15 a.m. Any questions? What? No meeting Tuesday. Meeting adjourned.